Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA and their yearly writers' conference. It'll be this July at pnwa.org. I think I mentioned last week, I'm teaching at the Chuckanuck Writers Conference up in Bothell, Washington in June. I'll be teaching at the PNWA conference also, of course, in July. But in June, I'll be teaching at the Chuckanuck Writers Conference, and I will also be teaching a special one-day master class the Thursday before the conference. Let's see, that's going to be Thursday, June 17th, the PNWA conference. The master class is June 26th. That's filling up quick. There may not even be any spaces left. So if you're going to the Chuckanut Writers Conference and you want to take a master class, you're going to sign up soon because we're almost full. So, you know, I was pacing around trying to figure out what to say about today's guest. She's a return guest, Holly Robinson. I interviewed her a year and a half ago, maybe, when she released Wishing Hill. And another book just came out, Beach Plum Island, her second with the Penguin. I think it was her second with Penguin, her second novel anyway with Penguin. That just came out April 1st, Beach Plum Island. And, you know, the fact is I just like her. I got to talk to her a year and a half ago, like I said, when she released her first book. And I thought she was funny, and I thought she was smart, and she had a lot of great things to say about the writing process and what it is to live as a writer. And I just like talking to her. And one of the great things about having your own show is if you want to talk to someone again, you can just invite them back on. So that's just what I did, and now she's here with me today. Aren't you? Holly, hello.
I am here, and I'm so glad to be here. I'm so glad to have an excuse to talk to you again. I think I should just keep publishing books so I can keep being on your show. That's my goal.
Whatever it takes, Holly, to inspire you to do that, I say keep doing it. And let me say congratulations on Beach Plum Island, another fine offering.
Thank you so much.
Funny. And quite readable. And so that, again, that just came out April 1st. It's Penguin, yeah?
It came out April 1st. It's with Penguin. The Wishing Hill was also with Penguin.
Right.
So this is actually my third novel I've published. I published a novel called Sleeping Tigers. I self-published that, and then Penguin gave me a contract for The Wishing Hill, and then they bought Beach Plum Island. Oddly, on the basis of a synopsis, not an entire manuscript. I know you and I have talked a little bit about how you sell books. And yes, I know. It happens only in the movies, right? Well, so it turns out that you don't always have to write an entire manuscript to sell a novel, which is always what I had thought, and certainly how I had been trying to sell novels previously. But once you're with a publisher, or this particular publisher anyway, you can write a synopsis, which is basically like a movie pitch. You know, this happened, then this happened. It's some of the possibly the worst writing you've ever done in your life. But you basically just tell the publisher what the story will be. And in this case, I didn't even ask for sample chapters. It was a miracle. My editor called to tell me they were going to buy Beach Plum Island, and I thought I had misheard her. I was in an airport, and I was on a movie sidewalk, and I was just still floating on cloud nine because they had bought one novel from me because it had taken me a long time, like over 20 years, to publish a novel with a traditional publisher, which had been my goal. And she called and said, yeah, we really like the synopsis, so we want to buy Beach Plum Island. And what I thought she was saying was, okay, now you can go do some sample chapters, and we'll look at those.
Right.
And if we like those, we'll ask for the whole manuscript, kind of what the process was for selling the first novel. And no, she said, we just want to buy it. So I just, I almost keeled over the railing of the moving sidewalk, luggage and all, you know, but luckily did not. But yeah, that's how I sold it. And then from there, I sold the next novel, which is coming out next April, called Haven Lake. And it's coming out, a year from Beach Plum Island. And I sold that on the basis of a synopsis as well. And not only that, they gave me a two-book contract so that, and they don't even have the synopsis for the next one after Haven Lake. So I'm very puzzled by the whole process, but I will take it. I will gladly take it.
Absolutely. Well, now my question to you is, you write a synopsis for Beach Plum Island. How much like the synopsis is the actual book? Or are you someone who gets into it and then things take over and characters take over and it changes? Or did it stay pretty much to the synopsis?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I was terrified to write a synopsis. When she told me I had to write one, I really freaked out. I'd never written one. I started doing all that Googling on the Internet to find sample synopses, and you can find them online. And a friend of mine who also writes fiction was very generous about sharing hers. And I was petrified to write one. And also, I was petrified for two reasons. First of all, I thought I couldn't do it successfully and that they wouldn't like it. And then secondly, I thought if they did buy the book on the basis of a synopsis, then what would happen? Where would be the magic in the process? Because I've always written kind of by the seat of my pants. Like, I want to find out what the story is.
Sure.
So I write it, entertain myself. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to kill it. You know, if I spill it all out on the page, I'm going to kill the idea. But in fact, what ends up happening is a lot of surprises on the way and along the way. And yes, the story was still true to its original shape in the synopsis, in that this book was based on a family mystery that my mom told me when I was a little kid. When my brother and I were children, she used to tell us this story mostly to keep us from fighting in the car. She told us a lot of stories. And the story she told was about when she was a babysitter and she was, you know, 12 years old in rural Maine. And the family left and said, okay, the kids are asleep and you can have a snack in the kitchen and do your homework. But whatever you do, don't go in the back bedroom of the house. And so, of course, you know, my mom, being 12 and curious, the first thing she does, and no sooner is the car out of the driveway than she's going right down to the back bedroom and listening at the door, and there's this scratching sound. And then she opened the door, and this little child came flying out of there, you know, kind of clawing at her and making animal noises. And it was like this feral child that had been locked in this back bedroom. And so she told me that hair-raising story, and I always wanted to know, well, Mom, why? Like, what happened? Why was he in the bedroom? What happened to that poor kid? And she didn't know, of course. And so I had to make up a story to go along with what happened to that child. So the bones of the novel, that was it. That was the start of that novel. And then I built characters around that story who could tell that story for me. That all stayed the same as the synopsis, but they did very surprising things along the way. Like, I didn't really know how they were going to get from point A to point B in my plot points in the synopsis, because the synopsis is only 5 pages long. There's a lot of meat in a novel between that.
There's a lot.
That's the
thing is, you know, this I've always thought about the writing process, is that you get into the writing, and the fact is, you can have this idea for just a scene, but one sentence can change it dramatically. And if it comes, and if that sentence comes out and it's a true sentence, and you know it belongs there, if you pull it out, you know you're pulling out an actual piece of the story. And so, how can you know for sure where things will go?
You can't. And you know, the thing is, the editor knows that you can't, and she will, or my editor is, I think, the smartest editor in the entire universe. I probably said that in our last interview, but I still feel that's true. I just adore and revere this editor, so I'm so glad I'm with her. And this is, she knows that things will change shape, but as long as the storyline is basically, they want to know what you're going to deliver. I mean, a book is a product like anything else you make to sell in the marketplace, and so they want to know, what are we buying for our money? What are we paying you to do? We're paying you to do this task, to tell a story that will appeal to the readers that we're going to market this book to. And you have to tell it in the abbreviated form in a way that will appeal to those that we know will appeal to our audience. And so that's what you have to do with a synopsis, essentially. And in this case, they market a lot to women readers, and they have... their books tend to be emotionally complex books, and so it's a particular kind of book, just like if I were with a line of, you know, history books or mysteries, whatever.
So So, all right. So, yeah, I knew that this was your fourth book total. You wrote, I mean, fourth, you had
yes,
your memoir.
Yes, I had a memoir that I published with Random House.
Right.
Yeah, that was in 2009. Mm-hmm.
And then you wrote the, it's the Tiger, sorry, I'm trying to remember.
Sleeping Tigers.
Sleeping Tigers, which you weren't able to sell, so you self-published it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, my agent had shopped around a number of novels for me, and then Sleeping Tigers was the one I had liked the best, and so that's the one I chose to self-publish. And then 2 weeks after I self-published it, he sold The Wishing Hill to Penguin.
Right. Okay. So now you published Wishing Hill. So a lot of the success we're talking about now has come about fairly recently in your long writing life.
Oh, yes, yeah? Very. It's like the last 10 seconds of my writing career. Yeah,
that's right.
Basically.
It's like in the history of the world, how humanity's always been like, well, that's just true for you, right, for this, what we're talking about now. But, so here's my question to Holly. So you go out with Wishing Hill, and you probably did some kind of book tour, right?
Well, you know, they don't really send you on book tour so much anymore.
I know, but
you
did something,
but
didn't
I
you?
Did, like yes. I did some events, yes.
And you must have heard from – so now you've begun to meet your readers,
yes.
Who your readers are. Are they at all on your mind as you're writing your next books, or in a way have you always been writing for them and it's only now that you've met them? I think I've
always been writing for them. However, I do go to a lot of book clubs and bookstores and libraries, and it's fascinating to me to meet readers who connect with my books in so many different ways. And I would say overall, most of them connect with them emotionally. Like they talk about the characters, like the characters are real people. Like, I don't understand why she left her husband. She should have stayed with him. You know, they'll say things like this. Or, you know, like I was doing these meet and greet things you do at Barnes & Noble, which are, at first I thought I wouldn't like them because basically they post you in some really visible, obvious place where you could feel no more self-conscious than if you were standing there in your underwear. And you're standing there, like, by the cafe or the front door with a big poster over your head, book signing today. And you think, who is going to stop here? But it's surprising. You end up chatting with a lot of people, and they are good about it, and, like, they make an announcement, like, every 15 minutes. Meet author Holly Robinson. Her family mystery is a true story based on three sisters who discover a brother they never knew they had, or some line like that. And I had this woman come flying over to my table and say, oh, my cousin just found out she had a sister she never knew she had. So you get into these conversations, these real-life conversations, and you realize everybody's life is filled with these stories that could become novels, you know. And so that's the most exciting thing to me is that – so I do – in a way, I was writing for them already, and then meeting these readers is enriching what I write. Like the novel I'm writing now, Haven Lake, is enriched by a few stories people have told me along the way because they've become infused into my book.
Yeah. Well, you know, something you said struck me. I had just written a blog or an essay blog about this quality of what the writing is, which is your readers come up and say of your fictional characters, they talk about them like real people, like friends who went and did these things they disapprove of or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, what's so interesting about the job of the writer, particularly the fiction writer, is you're trafficking, your currency is just a dream, but you as the writer have to treat it as real in order to do your job. But you're dealing with nothing.
True.
It's just thought. It's just, it is in a way, make-believe. But it has to be real. You have to feel it so that your readers will have that experience. Because to them, it's just as real, while they read, hopefully, as a friend they know. And yet it's all
and
nothing.
You have to, and not only that, you have to feel it over and over and over again.
Oh,
because as anybody who has written a novel knows, you don't write just one draft. You write, like, you know, 11,000 drafts of certain pages anyway, and you know, probably 11 drafts of the entire book. And I knew, like, for instance, at Beach Plum Island, I knew that I had succeeded in getting emotion on the page because I cried while I was editing it every single time at certain places. And so then I knew, okay, this is real. And I was worried about Haven Lake for a while, and then I made myself cry with a couple of different new scenes, and I thought, okay, there it is. You know, there's what I want. And laugh, too, of course, you know, not just sobbing as I write. But there's some movie with – I forget what it is with Diane Keaton where she's a writer and she's a playwright. Do you know that movie?
Yes,
and she's
I do.
Sobbing.
Yes, it's the one with Jack Nicholson. in it.
Yeah, and she's pounding out the pages. Oh, yep. And that's what it feels like sometimes.
Yeah, but that's the good stuff. Then you know you hit it because you know the thing is, you don't know. It's nice that your editors and your publisher are buying the books without it being written. But the thing is, you don't really know what your editor is going to like, and you don't really know what your readers are going to like, although you can guess.
No.
But you can always know what you like. You can always know whether you're moved or not. That's the one thing you absolutely can
know. That is correct. That is absolutely correct. And the thing is, you have to, in some ways, ignore all the outside voices while you're writing, because otherwise you'd drive yourself crazy. I mean, especially, you know, in this day and age when you can buy, you know, self-published books that are written, and some of them are quite good, as you know. I mean, I think mine was pretty good. But a lot of self-published books are good, and some of them are, you know, not as good, but they're still, they might not be as literary as you would ordinarily read, but they move really fast. And so, they're kind of meant to do that. And so you'll get readers of your books, if you're a more literary writer, who say, oh, your book is too slow. You have too much description. And you can't worry about that, because it's, if you like those descriptions and that's what carries the book, you keep those descriptions, you know, you have to do that. Otherwise, we would be writing for trends that might not exist tomorrow anyway. So you have to be true to your own self as a writer and true to your story more than anything.
And the gold that you offer everybody is your particular vision. That's the gift that you have to give, is the thing that you think is so lovely or so cool or so profound or so, because that's, what better thing can you give than that? Mm-hmm. And no matter what you write, so my younger son, who I'm doing homeschooling with now, really wants to create stuff, but he's terrified of doing it wrong. And all I can say to him again and again and again is, the best thing you can give people is what you think is funny. If you think it's cool, then give it. Because no matter what we put out there, someone is not going to like it.
That's right.
No matter what.
And like your guest, what was his name? Will Norris, the guest you had last time, I think. Yeah, you know, that writer. He said, you know, the one sure way to fail is to not try, and that's so true. There's nothing truer than that when you're writing, because you won't. You know, everyone says, well, how do you get published? Well, you just keep writing, because that's the only sure thing I can tell you, is you will not get published if you stop writing. So you have to just keep putting the words out there.
So let me ask you this. So you have written a number of things. You've had a really varied career in a lot of ways. You've done some. You wrote a memoir. You've published three novels. You have written a bunch of essays for like Ladies' Home Journal and Boston Globe and, well, I can't remember where all else. Actually, a number
pretty
of places.
Pretty much. Like, yeah, I have one coming out at Redbook in July, and Better Homes and Gardens, Huffington Post. Yeah.
So what pleases you the most? I mean, you're a writer, so you like to write. But what is the easiest fit for Holly? Is it fiction, or is it really? Are all those things make up your writing?
Well, I think I have twin loves. The first is fiction, and the second is, I think, ghostwriting. I really love being. I'm a celebrity ghostwriter, and I really love writing for celebrities. I really love inhabiting other people's lives, like the lives of people who get to ride in limos and, you know, live in mansions in Miami, or get to, you know, perform on Broadway or be in the movies. You know, it's such an interesting life, and I learn so much from the celebrities I work with, because they work so hard. You know, they more than anyone else have taught me, again, you just can't quit trying or you will fail. They keep reinventing themselves to succeed, and I think that's great. And I love being a voice for people who otherwise might not be able to put a voice on the page. That's my favorite. Yeah, in addition to fiction, I would say that's my favorite job.
I have to ask you about that. So when you ghostwrite for them, you're writing in the first person, yeah?
Yeah, I'm writing a memoir, but from their point of view, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, all right, so how do you assume their voice? Because it has to be something, it has to be them in some way, even though it's you. How does that work? How do you find the voice that becomes them? Do you
just
mimic in a way?
Yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, in some cases, I'll get a manuscript that's in rough shape, and my job is to book doctor it. So then I just, you know, continue with that voice, and that's easy. Other times I write from the bottom up, you know, and just do a bazillion interviews, and they're either in person or on the phone or even Dropbox. In some cases, you know, they'll send me audio files if they're busy working on a shoot or something. And I can hear their voices, and I'm, you know, I love to write dialogue. So I'm good at hearing different voices and putting them on the page, I think. Yeah, that's how you do it. You just have to be a really good listener.
All right. So but I would think that somehow the skill that you employ to ghostwrite actually, and I'm just thinking of this now, so I don't know how this crosses over, but I feel like this crossover to fiction writing, that somehow, you know what it must be? Is it the part, because your ego has to go away to be the ghostwriter, right? I mean, you got to forget about Holly. Is that helpful when you sit down to write fiction?
Well, I think your ego goes away when you're a fiction writer, too. I think that if you're going to fully inhabit your characters, they can't respond to situations the way you would. You know, if I have a teenage boy in Haven Lake in the new novel I'm writing, and he just decided on impulse to not only run away from this farm, but to steal one of the lambs because he's protecting it from being butchered. And so he jumps into this woman's truck and steals the truck. Now, I might try to steal a lamb to keep it from being butchered, but I would never dare steal a truck, especially when it was a stick shift that I didn't know how to drive. Like this kid, well, that's too bad. I'm just going to learn how to do it right now. So of course, he has an accident, and that's, you know, that's the kind of, you have to really inhabit your character and think, what would that character do? And you have to lose yourself in the process of writing. And the same is true when you're ghostwriting. You follow that person's voice and that person's narrative. It's not your narrative. It's that person's narrative.
Yeah. We have a mutual friend here, I think, who wants to ask you a question.
Oh, sure.
Is that Jeff? Is that you, my friend?
It is, Wim. It is.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
Holly, how exciting this is to speak with two of my most favorite authors and writers and dearest friends, and I'm so thrilled for both of your inestimable successes in the publishing world. Keep it up, Jeff. And thanks for taking my question, Bill. Holly, my question is, so many novels and stories are based in such notable locations like New York, Paris, London, etc. Your newest novel, Beach Palm Island, is set in a little seacoast town in Massachusetts, which you and I know well, Holly. But how does a writer set the characters in a virtually obscure location and give it a sense of universality, which all our readers can relate to on a personal basis? In other words, feel like they are there with us.
I think that's a great question. I think in my case, I often use settings to enhance and enrich the novel. In this particular book, Beach Plum Island is Plum Island. It's a name for Plum Island, which is a real place in Massachusetts, and it's a barrier island. It's half bird sanctuary and half inhabited. And a barrier island serves to protect the mainland coast from things like, you know, northeasters and hurricanes. The mainland would just wash away without that barrier island. And it's an extended metaphor, really, for one of the characters in my novel, Ava, who's one of the sisters who finds out she has a brother she never knew she had, and she starts searching for him in the course of the novel. But also in the course of the novel, she falls in love with somebody who's totally inappropriate. Her two teenage sons are going to leave her and go to college. Her work life is taking off. Her ex-husband is getting married. So she has all of these things happening, and her life, like the island, is shape-shifting. And it's nothing that she recognizes, you know, and she's terrified. And I think that's what I wanted everyone to feel, that universal feeling of you may want your life to stay the same and safe and predictable, but guess what? All of these forces, emotional and otherwise, are going to come at you from all directions at unexpected times, and they will those forces will change you, and they will change your life, and you need to weather that. So I think that's why I chose that particular location, and I often do that with settings in my novel.
Right. And you see, what I like about that description is that in the end, it all comes down, everything is in service to the feeling, to the felt knowledge. I call it felt knowledge that you're trying to convey. In this case, that feeling that core truth, that thing, your life is going to change, honey. There's nothing you can do about it. And how and what it means to come to peace with that. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And so everything is in service to that. The land, the characters, everything is in service to that feeling you're trying to share with the readers.
Right. And it's a tricky thing in fiction because you want to do it. In The Wishing Hill, I had an old mill that did the same thing. They kind of stood in for as a metaphor for this tragic love affair. And it happened to be a mill that I looked at out my back bedroom window every day. I think I talked about it with you in our last interview. And you have to be careful not to be hammering your readers over the head with these particular descriptions, but have them be organic to the story. But we're lucky that we live in such a, well, you too, in such a place that's so, that lends itself to such wonderful naturalistic descriptions to help enhance the mood of your writing. It's just great.
But you've got to feel the land. I mean, the land has got, I always say that, you know, when you're writing, what things look like are not nearly as important as what it feels like to look at them. Is that
right?
Does that make sense? In other words, don't just tell me there's a hill. What does it look like? What does it feel like as a human being to look at that hill? It all comes back to feeling.
That's right, and your characters have to smell the wild grass that's just been cut on that hill. They have to see the moon rising over the hill. They have to feel the grass under their bare feet, and those physical sensations, they have to react to them and react to that setting in a way that makes sense for that particular character, and that will spark some memory or some action that they'll take as a result of being in that setting. And so that's what's interesting to play around with in fiction.
That's what's interesting to play. How it all connects, how everything connects.
Yeah, all those
connections. Emotional level. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, it's hard to believe to me, Holly, that we're almost at the end of our half hour. This always goes so quickly with you. And so...
it's always so much fun.
I know, that's right. Fun makes time fly. And so, my question to you is this, before we have to go. What, if you can answer this, what did you learn writing Beach Plum Island that stretched you and expanded you as a writer or just as a person, maybe?
I learned, that's a great question, and I have an easy answer. I learned to write from multiple points of view. Sleeping Tigers was from first person. The Wishing Hill had two points of view, but they were two, you know, really extensive points of view of women. And in Beach Plum Island, I have three sisters who are very different people, and one of them's a teenager. So I had to really inhabit those characters fully and make the voices sound distinct and give them their own personas. And that really stretched me as a writer, and I loved it. I loved the motion it gave the narrative, and I loved seeing each character from the other character's points of view. So that really, I felt, enhanced the story. Yeah.
Yeah, because that rounds everybody out, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And now, do you think you'll be doing that again?
I am. Yeah, I'm doing it in Haven Lake, and I even have a boy's point of view, which is unusual for me. I love it for a different reason. Both of them are family mysteries based on true stories, and in this particular instance, one of the mysteries happened 20 years ago, so one of the characters knows a lot about it, and the information gradually gets imparted to the other characters and to the reader as the other characters learn what really happened 20 years ago to shatter this particular idyllic community. That's fun to do in that way. So you drop the clues like you're writing a mystery novel.
That sounds awesome. Well, God, I have only a minute left. Holly, thank you so much. Beach Plum Island. Everybody buy it. Everyone.
Thank you so much.
You. You're welcome. Take it easy, Holly.
Okay, thanks. Bye, Bill.
Bye-bye. Multiple perspectives. You know what's funny? As I was told by some agents many years ago, don't write from multiple perspectives. Never do it. You know what? Everything works if it works. And it sure works in Beach Plum Island. So if you find something that works, then you got to use it. There's nothing else to do. I'll be here again next week, and I'll be talking to the wonderful Donna Bear Stein, publisher of Tiferet Journal and author in her own right. But until then, I want you all to go out and do something that you love. Write something you love.